Gail Pellet attracted a lot of attention when she arrived in China in 1980 to start a two-year stint as a foreign expert in the English language department of Radio Beijing. Ms. Pellet, a 37-year-old broadcast journalist who'd produced segments for PBS, NPR, and NBC, was the antithesis of the typical woman of Deng Xiaoping's China. She spoke loudly, wore her long red hair curly, and loved brightly colored clothing. Westerners were a rarity in China then. It was just 4 years after Mao Zedong's death and only 1 year after China and the United States had reestablished diplomatic relations. She describes her experiences in Forbidden Fruit, a memoir published by Van Damme. I'm very pleased that has brought her to our show today. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's been 25 years since you returned to the United States. Why have you waited so long to write this book?
35 years. Yes, oh. I came back in 81. So it's an important question because I did try to write the book when I first returned. And I soon ran into what I call the wall of consequences. Hmm. Even the most innocent stories about my Chinese colleagues, the comrades at Radio Beijing, or acquaintances, or friends, or most painfully lovers, could cause so many problems for them because there was a policy that forbade normal relationships between foreigners and the Chinese. And I was particularly radioactive because I was a journalist from the West. And even though in this great contradiction that I was invited for my broadcast journalism expertise and asked to teach courses in broadcast journalism, I was treated as a Western spy. So when I started to write this book and realized that even if I changed the names of the people around me, the surveillance was so thorough of me at all times that they would figure out who I was talking about. And those Chinese could lose a lot. They could lose promotions, housing, access to schooling for their kids, or worse.
Now, you say you were treated as a Western spy. Actually thought of as a Western spy or somebody who might possibly be a Western spy?
Well, I would say that the freeze around me that would sometimes melt a little bit because it's pretty hard for people to work alongside somebody 6 days a week and treat them as a pariah in some sense. And so it would come and go a little bit. But no Chinese colleague would dare speak alone with me, to be seen alone speaking with me. And eventually one of the very courageous comrades there in the English department at Radio Beijing told me, she said, Gail, if they are seen talking to you, and we're talking about a journalistic organization here where we need to talk about everything going on in the world, in the city, in the town, in our minds, whatever.
And developing stories,
right? And we'll get to that. But she said, you know, if they're seen talking to you, they risk losing everything. So even though the Cultural Revolution was over in 1976, mm-hmm. It wasn't really over.
And so when the Gang of Four was finally lost power, the paranoia still remained? I thought Deng Xiaoping was kind of the Gorbachev of China, the man who opened things up.
Well, I was there. I mean, the fall of 1980 was the trial of the Gang of Four. So this was the effort of the party to put that period of history at rest and away, and to pin it all on these four people. And of course, the risk with that trial was that Mao would become implicated, and they did everything they could to prevent that from happening. But the legacy of, even though that was, sort of some kind of termination officially of the Cultural Revolution, the legacy of mistrust and suspicion was one of the most damaging, outcomes and legacy of that big movement and previous ones as well.
And America, of course, had been the great enemy. So even if people are told it's no longer true, you just don't get past that quickly. There'd been a lot of commitment to the Cultural Revolution. People had done absolutely crazy things.
Well, you know, I was part of a generation, a 60s activist generation, very active in the anti-war movement, the new feminist movement, the environmental movement. And we were influenced by what we thought the Cultural Revolution was about. We thought it was an egalitarian movement, anti-authoritarian, anti-bureaucratic. And what young person wouldn't like to be part of that as they saw, you know, raised fists and hands and arms? And we challenged our professors and we challenged the curriculum to be relevant. We didn't kill our professors. We didn't beat them to death. We didn't leave them without medical care after being injured. There is so much about the Cultural Revolution, and, you know, you could fill several programs with it.
I remember how art magazines like Art Forum would sometimes discuss the importance of Maoism to contemporary art. But my own experience, and I'm sorry if I'm taking away from your story for just a moment, I went to London in 1971, was at Hyde Park, and somebody was handing out little red books, and I took one just out of curiosity. And when I opened it and found that it was filled with things like, when the people start moving, no one can stop them, I thought, this is the most ridiculous thing. This is what has motivated millions of people to march across China and to destroy so many people's lives?
Well, it was a manipulated movement, and things went very wrong very fast. And that's, you know, more than 300 professors or teachers and principals were killed in Beijing alone in the first year. But that's why they came up with the idea of the sent down youth. They sent all the young people to the countryside to kind of cool that out. But it is a sidebar. But it was something that certainly my small cohort of the earliest foreign expert workers, we were called foreign experts, working in Beijing after a 30-year closed door in China, we were shocked at the stories we were starting to hear about the Cultural Revolution. The first stories were being translated into English that year that I arrived. And
were you the only English speaker at Radio Beijing?
Well, the only English-speaking expert, mm-hmm. Yes. There were, you know, they are the rough, very rough equivalent of Voice of America, so they broadcast in 4 dozen languages.
There were people speaking French, and there were other people there.
Yes, yes, all those
to do German and whatever.
Yes, yes, exactly. And we were shocked to hear what had really gone on during the Cultural Revolution. People being thrown out of windows in places like China Reconstructs, a magazine that other foreign expert friends worked at. But we couldn't get our colleagues to talk about it. If I ever raise questions in the department with any of my colleagues about the Cultural Revolution, they would leave the room.
How long did it take after you arrived in Beijing before you realized that you weren't cut out to live under an authoritarian system of government?
Well, it happened pretty quickly. I think that notion of the legacy of what had ever had gone on there that led to so much fear and suspicion, I came up against that very quickly. And then, of course, there was the crisis of where I was working. I had come out of 10 years of working with commercial radio, community radio, Pacifica Radio, National Public Radio. I had produced documentaries and plays and public affairs programs. And I was, in a way, a Deng Xiaoping hire. I was hired to teach this new journalism because he was rising to power with a vision of opening and reform. Okay, the first business people from the West coming in, and as you said in the intro, the American embassy just set up shop a year before I arrived. The first foreign reporters were just coming in, Fox Butterfield, etc.
And Deng Xiaoping had been accused of being a little too capitalist roader before when he lost power. He was brought back to push China into a new direction. But it sounds to me like it was a harder transition than one might have imagined. And then, of course, you had other issues. You were warned that you had to break off a relationship you'd started with a Chinese law student.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have a personal life as well?
Well, it happened over and over again.
You had a number of relationships of that sort.
Well, it started the day I arrived. I arrived in the Beijing airport, and a very nice gentleman with a three-piece suit on that looked a little uncomfortable in the suit, Chinese, said to me, I'm standing there, I'm the only bizarre-looking person in the arrivals, because, you know, with my wild red hair, everybody else is local Chinese. And he said to me, you know, well, what are you doing here and what are you going to do? And I said I was going to be working at Radio Beijing. And I asked him, you know, if he lived here or in the U.S. or abroad. And he said, no, he was from here. He had just been to visit the United States for the first time in 40 years, okay, which would explain, you know, what had happened perhaps to him since he'd gone to Harvard, where he'd gone to school in the 50s or 40s. No, it would be in the 40s. And so I said, well, you know, a lot of changes. So we chit-chat a little bit, and he gave me his card, and he said, I would be so delighted to hear from you and hear your impressions. Well, when I went to my office, of course, I didn't speak any Chinese. I couldn't make a phone call. I asked the woman, the party member, who I call my shadow through the book, because she was my shadow, to make the call for me. And when I could tell from the tone of her voice that she did not want me to make this connection with this person. And she said, oh, he's not available and he's never going to be available. And I knew right then that there was going to be this problem of making connections with the Chinese, and I was going to be watched. And
your mail was opened?
My mail was opened.
You suspected that your phone was bugged?
Oh, we all knew that, and those of us who were
And were you being followed all the time?
Well, in those days, you know, the surveillance, when we think of surveillance now, which is so thorough and penetrating and digital and everything, in those days it was chits of paper and people who just knew your movements and knew everything about you. If I had to call, I didn't have a private telephone. I had a phone in the hallway at the Foreigners Building where I worked. If I had to call to get a taxi to go out in the evening, they would know. I mean, all of that is kept track of, where you're going. And it would be evident in the kinds of questions sometimes the colleagues would ask me.
And you said that the only time you felt free was when you could go out riding in your bicycle at night. But you chose to ride at night because during the day people would point to you and yell Wai Wuren and Lao Wai, which what means foreigner and outsider?
Foreigner and outsider. Yes, I mean, you have to understand, this is at the very beginning of foreigners beginning to go and live and work in China. So I was a huge attraction. If I stopped on a bicycle ride of a Sunday afternoon to try to find, you know, a soda to drink and drink it in an alleyway or a hutong, within a moment, 40 people would be pressing in on me to examine my clothing, but particularly my shoes. And
which I now would be made in China.
Yes, of course, the ironies of all of it. But and then I often caused traffic accidents. I could see men who were looking at me and would bicycle into the back of a truck or something. But that's why I started writing at night, so I wouldn't be noticed. The gaze wasn't on me. I could look. And that all I had were my eyes at the beginning, because I didn't speak Chinese initially.
My guest is Gail Pellett, P-E-L-L-E-T-T. She's written a memoir called Forbidden Fruit, 1980 Beijing. You were assigned an apartment in a building reserved exclusively for foreigners, and there were guards with machine guns that controlled access. Were they there to watch you or to prevent Chinese people from coming into the building?
Well, it wasn't a machine gun. It was a rifle. But yes, they were in a little hut, and nobody could come and go from that building without going past that man with the rifle. And even if I took a taxi back at night, if the taxi, you know, he would make the taxi stop, and the taxi drivers sometimes would get very frustrated and just, you know, they knew they were just dropping me off at the door and returning out. They sometimes just sped up and dropped me at the door, and the guy would go ballistic and come out with his rifle pointed and things. Now, over time, I began to understand that there was another side to that protection, that it had a protective side that might have been, not a malign thought, but that there were several exiles among us in the building who were had come from countries, and they were working in the language departments in Central Broadcasting. They were working in countries that had military coups, and they were leftists in their countries and activists. And if the new military government installed in an embassy in Beijing knew about their whereabouts, they were quite nervous. And some of them came to me to ask me to not mention their existence, never mention that there's a Turkish couple living in my building.
What was your apartment like? I assume it was fairly small.
Well, you know, I had lived in a life pretty much on the edge in New York before. You don't earn a lot of money working at Pacifica and NPR in the late 70s.
Even today.
And even today. And I had lived in pretty simple apartments and tenements in New York. I wasn't concerned about the size of my foreign expert's apartment. It had no kitchen. That was the problem, because you were supposed to eat communally in the dining room in the building. And while at first that thought of having, you know, a few people around to talk to during a meal looked attractive, after a while, I soon got a refrigerator and a hot plate like everybody else, and, you know, cut vegetables on my coffee table and hacked chickens. And
how did it compare to the apartments of some of your Chinese colleagues?
Oh, the housing crisis was so severe when I was in Beijing. You know, I arrived in a China that was very poor. So housing, food, cloth for clothing, access to higher education, all was rationed. And there was a very severe housing crisis, because several generations, including children, would be sharing one or two rooms and sharing with other families kitchens in the hallways and bathrooms. And if you were in an older type building or the traditional housing, you would have public bathrooms in the middle of the block, and then you would have a bathhouse at your work unit. And so I arrived in that China, and Deng Xiaoping was, of course, rising in power with his vision of opening, reforming, transforming the economy, but never the political, never the party. He was strengthening the party because it had been so undermined during the Cultural Revolution. So just before I arrived, the new democracy movement had just been crushed. The democracy
Tiananmen Square.
Not Tiananmen Square. That comes later, after I left. It's the democracy wall movement that began in 78 and called for the fifth modernization. You know, Deng had his program of four modernizations: industry, agriculture, military, science, all that kind of stuff. And they called for the fifth modernization. And one of them, Wai Jianqing, very famous voice, very eloquent at that time on those democracy wall posters, called for democracy and accused Deng Xiaoping of becoming the new dictator. So he was arrested. But what his real crime was, talking to foreign journalists. And that's why I was also so suspect, because there I was, invited to work inside Central Broadcasting Radio Beijing, and I was a journalist. So I was always suspect.
Part of your job, as you understood it, was to teach your Chinese colleagues writing, editing, and production skills, but they didn't seem to be all that interested in learning them. In fact, they told you that they didn't even listen to the broadcasts of Beijing Radio. How long after you arrived did you realize that Radio Beijing was mainly producing propaganda and that the organization had no interest in meeting Western journalism standards?
Well, that came pretty quickly. You know, the program was made up of reading magazine articles on the air, magazine articles, and they would actually say this. This is an article from Women in Sports, blah, 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 or China Reconstructs. There'd be no byline. There'd be, if somebody was quoted, there would never be an identity. There would never be anything you could check as facts. And, of course, I was going totally nuts, and I would be pursuing, you know, all my colleagues to do this. Well, I soon learned they were all translators. They were hired and assigned to these jobs out of foreign language school. None of them had ever been to journalism school. Their journalism schools didn't exist at that point. They were just beginning at like People's Daily.
We don't have a lot of time, so I can't tell these wonderful stories about lunchtime routine at your office where employees had 2.5 hour lunches and the reason for that, or the story you tell about inviting two of your colleagues and their spouses to your apartment and 12 people showing up. That's all part of the fun of reading this book. But what happened when you came back? You say that you had that people treated you with suspicion.
Well, here I was treated as if I was a spy in China, in Beijing. And then when I came back, I wanted to return to China because I felt I had all this specialized knowledge. I'd worked inside a Chinese institution. I knew something. So when I went to the networks and I went to NPR in Washington, the head of the news division, I felt that people looked at me, you worked for the Chinese, as if I had a red star stuck in the middle of my forehead. And so I felt that I was tainted, you know, that they were treating me as if I was tainted because I would do that, when in fact I felt I had all this special expertise. But I think when I came back, the most important thing was to be able to reflect on this experience.
Well, fortunately, eventually you were hired as a producer at the McNeil Era NewsHour, then later by Bill Moyers. And Gail Pellett will be doing a reading and signing at the Powerhouse Arena from 7 to 9 p.m. That's tonight. The address is 37 Main Street in Brooklyn. For more information, go to wmyc.org/lopate. The book, Forbidden Fruit, 1980 Beijing, is published by Van Damme. Gail, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.